I just want to say a quick thanks to everyone who has left a podcast review so far. It's been fantastic to see what you guys are making of the podcast and really enjoy reading them. Rest assured, I do read every single one. So thanks again. And if you haven't left a review yet, it would do us a massive favor if you would, as that would help us grow this community and reach more grassroots coaches who will benefit from these conversations. So thanks again, and we really appreciate it. Welcome to the Athletic Evolution Podcast. Today, I'm speaking with Andy Kirkland. Andy has been working professionally in sport for the last 10 years, initially as a sports scientist at the Scottish Institute of Sport, then British Cycling, and now as a lecturer in sports coaching at the University of Stirling. He's been involved at every level, ranging from teaching young children to swim, working with development and performance athletes, through to providing high-performance support to international-level coaches and athletes. As well as having a PhD in sports science, Andy is a British Association of Exercise Sciences, accredited sport and exercise scientist with chartered scientist status. His academic background, exploring mental health and well-being, influences the way he thinks and attempts to solve problems. However, his experiences at the coalface are important to what he does. His developing expertise in behavioural change science helps him make sense of highly complex coaching environments. So welcome to the podcast, Andy. It's a pleasure to have you on today.
Thanks very much for inviting me, Rob.
No, well, I mean, having read, you know, the work that you put out, the kind of warts and all guide, I thought it was really relevant and really applicable to my audience. So I thought I'd love to get you on to dig into that. But before we go down that, give us your backstory. What's your philosophy as a coach, and how have you arrived where you're at?
Oh, what's my philosophy as a coach? Yeah, it's absolutely indefinable. I would say that I'm a problem solver and a realist. So I look at the world, what's going on in the world, and use my experiences to inform on how I solve problems. So right now I'm a high performance triathlon coach, and that supports my work. I'll have to be careful in case the boss listens to this, but I'm a lecturer in sports coaching at the University of Stirling too. So I tend to work with professional coaches, not necessarily high performance coaches, but those from grassroots right up to Olympic level on an MSc in performance coaching. Now, my philosophy though, where does it come from? So like many coaches, I didn't really like school, didn't engage with school, stared out of the window most of the time. Unlike many people in sport though, I was quite fat and ginger, didn't do I played a bit of rugby when I was younger, tight head prop, but then fell out of that and was a typical council estate kid who did all those sorts of things that go with the teenage years when I was brought up in the late 80s, early 90s. I found myself in riding a bike though, and just got absolutely obsessed with riding a bike. So I went from being an obese kid to actually well underweight, but wasn't a great athlete. Then I found myself in the underground techno scene, clubs and whatever, for a number of years. And that got a little bit messy. In coming out of it, I started doing triathlon. And I was introduced to a great coach, a guy called Darren Smith, who's worked with multiple world champions. He's a little Australian guy, one wonderful guy who's every single conversation I've had with, it impacts on my practice now. And I suggested I wanted to be a coach. And he said, well, what do you know? I suggested I knew an awful lot. And the guy pulled me apart and said, you need to study. So I went away to university when I was about 30 and did a sports science degree, ended up doing a PhD afterwards, and fell into working within the Scottish Institute of Sport as a physiologist. After that, I moved to British Cycling as a coach developer there, designing courses, working with coaches at every level of the sport. So even speaking to Sir Dave B in the cafe and stuff like that. And eventually I found myself as a lecturer at the University of Stirling. So what's my philosophy? My philosophy is informed on by that journey, just as much as the all-nighters in clubs listening to techno music and engaging with other people and learning about them and having a great time, through to the real challenges in high-performance sport, seeing things that I didn't necessarily want to see, having experiences I didn't necessarily want to have. But these experiences have really lit a fire in my tummy to say, well, I want sport to be better. I want people to have a really positive experience. And what drives my own philosophy of coaching is that I conflate health, mental health, and performance. They're the same thing to me. So that we shouldn't be compromising people's welfare for the sake of driving towards the best performance possible. So that's the underpinning of all my philosophy, is to do good and make things better for people in sport.
Mm. So let's jump into, you obviously wrote that Warts and All Guide to Being an Athlete in a High Performance Environment. And I you know, started reading that, and a lot of that resonated with me in terms of, you know, being on the side that I'm in terms of the academy environment, and lots of things that you spoke about really had a lot of truth to them. So what was your motivation for putting something like that out in the public domain?
Number of motivations. First of all, I'm involved in supporting coaches and athletes in terms of their welfare, and some of the rather unpleasant stories we've seen in the press recently, say with gymnastics and other things I can't really mention in a podcast. And it's been fascinating to engage with coaches, with NGBs, and with athletes to hear all the different perspectives. And these perspectives, they're all valid ones. But I sense that many people want the same thing, but are pulling in different directions. Also, as a coach educator, someone that teaches coaches, I'm frustrated at some of the content I'm given to deliver on courses and so on. It portrays coaching as this pleasant, nice thing to do, we're expected to present an idealistic vision of what coaching looks like. The reality is that sport is reflective of the rest of society. So good things happen, bad things happen. And most of the things that, as a coach, that take up people's time, it is interacting with others and trying to solve problems that don't necessarily relate to performance. And part of that relates to the triangle between coaches, athletes, and parents. I think in the context of the podcast here, people are pulling in different directions. Here at NGBs and from coaches, that parents are viewed as pains in the bum that are really problematic and hard to handle, and lots of stories of pushy parents. And I ask the question, well, how do you engage with them? What's the dialogue you have with them? What do they understand of the performance environment? And what are their skills and knowledge in terms of supporting their children, who they care very deeply about? We all care about the same thing, but we care in a different way. And to actually make a difference, we've all, whether I'm a coach, whether it's a parent, whether it's an NGB, we've got to recognize what the goals of each other are. And the reality right now, much as it may be unsalutary to some, is that if young people are driven to be the best they can be and aspire to be a professional athlete or to make it to the top, then they're going into a dog-eat-dog world in which failure is far more likely than success. And if we present this picture, a nice, pleasant picture, that everything's nice and shiny, I believe that it's a shock when people find it's not. There's a key thing I wrote in that article, particularly for parents, is that I as a coach, and if I'm working with children, that your children are very, very important to me. Their dreams, their aspirations, them having fun is absolutely critical to what I deliver. But as individuals, they're not special. They're important, but they're not special. That means that it's important to view the children of other people as important as your own within wider society. And that's the way, hopefully, that coaches see it as well, that everyone's important in teams, everyone's important within squads, but the metric in which in performance sport coaches and NGBs and federations are judged on is performance. And if someone's not good enough to perform, then they're going to get dropped like a hot potato. That's the reality. It's a commoditized environment in which there's lots of caring people that want the best, but the reality is that it's likely to end in failure, or if it ends in success, i.e. achieving these goals, say at world level, then life doesn't suddenly get any easier. There's just new challenges to deal with. And what we should be doing as a whole, whether it's coaches, athletes, parents, other stakeholders, is trying to make that environment as healthy as possible, so, and as undamaging as possible to individuals.
Mm. One of the points, and I guess you've kind of touched on this already, and you mentioned in the article, is that sport is ruthless, particularly around a lack of understanding expectation of what is actually required in a high performance setting. And that's kind of, you've touched on that about people kind of looking at it and it kind of being this glistening, shiny environment, but people don't have an expectation or understanding of what is actually required at that elite level. So could you kind of explain your kind of thought process around that ruthlessness of sport for the listeners?
The simple ruthlessness is that if you don't perform, you don't continue on the pathway. It's as simple as that. That doesn't mean to say that people can't continue on another pathway and continue to enjoy sport. So I'm relatively rubbish at what I do. I do triathlon and I train hard. What I've got consistent with top athletes is that fire burns. I want to do my absolute best and I love what I do. And the ruthlessness is that sometimes that joy is taken out of sport through the quest for professionalism and reaching the top. But as soon as that fire goes out, as soon as the joy of sport is removed, or the compulsion to do it, the want to get up in the morning and continue to do sport for yourself, some real intrinsic motivations, as soon as that goes, I think that's where the ruthlessness comes in, is that athletes are unlikely to progress on that journey. And even those that do may come out the other end not very happy as a result, i.e. being expected to perform for others, like a performing seal or a performing elephant. Like the performing elephant, if it's a happy elephant, great. If it becomes a grumpy elephant, people better watch out because there's going to be a mess.
That's really interesting, like what you mentioned there about, you know, that kind of pathway. If you don't perform, you don't continue, because there's a real contradiction in what we know about talent development, isn't there? And that, you know, talent ID, for as much as people like to think it's very accurate and reliable, we actually know it's not really. We're getting a snapshot of how someone's performing at an under 16 level. And there's a lot of assumptions that go along with that, that that's going to translate into an under 18 and under 20 and world level. And we know that actually there's a pretty minor relationship between those things. So it's easy for athletes to become, as you say, they lose the joy because they didn't get selected or didn't get, you know, that opportunity. Whereas actually we know if potentially we could keep that joy and keep them in some form of, whether it's recreational or semi-competitive or something, they might, you know, re-enter the pathway later on, because we know talent development isn't that nice linear trajectory, is it?
It's not. And I mentioned before we came on air as well that I worked with Scottish Rugby in an environment similar to yours on that type of pathway, where we were measuring performance through particular tests and trying to assess and measure talent. And sometimes what I think I lost as a physiologist is, right, you meet athletes, you see something special in them, just their behaviors, the way they attack tasks, the way they want to do things, and others that just don't necessarily want to be there. There's other things going on in their lives that suggest that this is a real hardship for them. And one of the things in that formalized testing I've seen with pro athlete, in fact, I don't do much formalized testing with any of the athletes I work with on a one-to-one basis. In fact, no lab testing. I do it all field testing and don't really concentrate on those numbers. So ultimately, for me, it's about looking at attitude. There's a really good model in education from someone called John Hattie and Donahue, and it's a really simple model, and it talks about skill, will, and thrill. And to continue along on an educational pathway, we need to recognize the skill, the will, and the thrill of those that we teach. And I think it's applicable to sport as well, is that if we can differentiate for different types of behaviors, because all humans are different, so what motivates them? What level of skill have they got? What level of engagement have they got? And what joy do they take out of their sport? And these are the fundamentals for me, is the skill, will, and thrill. And other things can develop slowly over time. So in a rugby context, for example, we know that for male athletes, for example, we've got the upregulation of testosterone and stuff like that at 17, 18. So we don't really know what someone's going to be like until they hit 17 or 18. And that's when we think, they could actually make that transition into the international game. Similar with triathlon, sport I work in, many athletes, particularly female ones, come into the sport relatively late, 24, 25, perhaps later, because the work ethic required is huge. We're training 17 to 30 hours a week, sometimes more on some programs. So that those early experiences being driven from 11 or 12 to be training and growing strong and everything, by the time you get to 21, 22, the will and the thrill has probably disappeared. And these are fundamental to performing at a top level, is just to that real motivation to be the best.
Yeah, it's really interesting, because I think there is, even now, there is still a tendency for coaches to get a glint in their eye when they see that kid who's, you know, in inverted commas, talented and is running rings around other kids. And, you know, when you start to dig under the hood, you know, you can start to, you know, do some of the more methodological things that we might do and say, well, actually, you know, that kid's born in the first quartile of your selection year. He's also an early maturer, and he's also had 5 years more formal coaching than the others. So actually, is he talented? Not really. He's just had a better head start physically, you know, physiologically, mentally, and from a technical perspective. And actually, you know, sometimes you're not judging apples and apples, you're judging apples and oranges, but you're getting, you know, you're getting carried away with that kid who you think is going to be the next big thing. And when people look back, they go, oh, why didn't that kid make it? And actually, you don't need to ask that many questions to figure out that motivation wasn't there, and he just enjoyed being the guy that scored 10 tries a game. He didn't like being the guy who was on the wrong end of a loss.
Yeah, an example I often use, and I know it's anecdotal and it's N equals one, so just one person, but I remember having Callum Skinner, so an Olympic cyclist medal winner, in my lab as maybe a 13-year-old or 14-year-old. And I'm sure Callum won't mind me saying that his numbers weren't huge, but what stands out is probably on reflection and thinking back, it's how did he transfer up to being an Olympic medal winner? And what I saw was really great motor control, something we in cycling we call souplesse. It's like a fluidity in pedaling, and really great leg speed. But he was 13 or 14 or whatever and hadn't built any strength. And when he hit about 19 or 20 and hit the gym, he was doing the gym before, but hit the gym, that muscle just started to grow, and he went from being a really good rider to a world-class one. But that, when you think back, you think, yeah, saw some things in him. But they wouldn't have been measured in a laboratory. They're that coaching instinct, the types of things you look for, the movement, the awareness, the asking questions, the drive, the types of things that are very difficult, if not impossible, to measure. These are the things that have always stood out in the people that I've seen have made the transitions. Similar with Sir Chris Hoy. We're in a training camp over in, of all places, Magaluf.
Who thought of that?
It was Scottish cycling. So I was over there with them. And this was before Chris was even British champion, just coming up to that stage. And we were all teasing him, more than gentle ribbing, because he was always on the sunbed, his feet up, when we were away training. He went away to his bed when we were getting lashed in the pub. We're in Magaluf, for goodness sake, and we're young people, so we're going to have fun. He wasn't doing it and took his training quite a bit more seriously than the rest of us. Now, we could never have guessed he would become one of the most famous Olympians, but Chris stood out from the rest of the group, just because his behaviours were different. He just approached cycling in a different way to the rest of us clowns.
That's really interesting, because when I look back now, and having been with Scottish Rugby coming up 4 years, starting to get players that I coached in that first kind of group signing professional contracts. And it is not, as you said, it's not the ones whose physical metrics were off the chart, or the guys who are the most technically adept. But looking at it now, they're the guys who every time you turned up to a session, you knew what you're going to get from them. Mm-hmm. You were going to get 100% effort, 100% focus. The guys who had the skill, but sometimes didn't fancy it or couldn't be bothered, or what, they just fell by the wayside and gradually got overtaken by those guys who were consistent and focused and diligent. So you're right. Sometimes things can't be measured on an ergometer or on a force plate. Actually, there's something underneath the hood that isn't so obvious, but takes time to kind of reap the benefits.
Mm-hmm. Well, Simone, who I coach, she's a great triathlete. So she won Ironman Wales as a pro last year, and being an amateur world champion and so on. So aiming for the top. But what always amazes me with her is that I prescribe a session and she gets it done. And sometimes I've pushed and pushed and pushed the limits of what I thought was possible, and she still delivers. And I'm astounded sometimes. It's, how did she do that? It doesn't make sense. I've got my models of what power she should be able to produce, and I've pushed these limits, and she's achieved. Now, I've got to be careful in what I say here, but there are certain aspects of these behaviors that are difficult to manage as well. So I sometimes think about myself as almost an addiction counselor rather than a coach. It's right. How do we manage this dose response of training for someone who's so intrinsically motivated to be the best? My job as a coach is to get inside her head, know how she ticks, and in that case, hold her back, because when a mind is stronger than the body, which is often the case with top performing athletes, the mind is really strong. It's how do we safeguard that body? How do we stop it breaking down? How do we stop them pushing too much in the gym? How do we stop them pushing their limits too often? And perhaps my experiences in some high performance environments where coaches haven't got so much time to get to know the individuals, they don't recognize almost these pathologically driven behaviors and think, oh, that person's fine. We can continue to push them. And the limits are pushed and pushed and pushed, and people with potential to be very, very good, if not international level athletes, break before they've reached their potential. And that's potentially because coaches aren't able to differentiate between athletes. And that's where I think we see some of the consequences, mental health, injury, all these things with athletes that, I think as a coach, I'm a professional. I know my trade inside out. I know it as well as most people. And I'm due that to my athletes because I'm asking them to put faith in me. And I'm part of that balance for them, is trying to help them achieve their potential, and it means getting inside their heads and knowing what drives individual behaviors, what's going on in family life, what are the stressors in family life and beyond, which influence that adaptation process as well. And what are these things that have happened in their life course, which makes them so driven? We know from the evidence that there's usually some sort of what would be considered to be a negative experience for those who are utterly driven. So how do we manage these things? And sometimes in sport, we lose sight of these problematic behaviors as well. And if you feed the behaviors, that's when health is compromised.
Hmm. So we obviously mentioned a little bit around the ruthless nature of sport and how, you know, it can be smooth sailing for a while and then suddenly that ruthless kind of nature can rear its head. So how do you think we can prepare parents and athletes themselves to be educated for when reality does hit?
I think it's a partnership. It's dialogue. It's speaking with each other. Saying if a coach, for example, is spending 50% of their time dealing with questions from parents or challenges from parents, how could that time be more effectively used to understand the questions that parents have got and what are their beliefs of what they need to be able to do to support a performance lifestyle? And there's really simple things like, do parents know what a performance diet looks like? Or are they serving up beans, chips, and goodness knows what at dinner time? So something that would really help is getting players or athletes, young athletes, to be cooking dinner, a performance dinner, a few times a week, and actually educating parents on what a performance diet is. There's real simple things. In my sport as well, in triathlon, there's a belief that you need all this fancy equipment. There's parents tend to be from an ABC1 demographic, i.e. professional people, quite a bit of income, particular types of mindsets that sometimes we would consider them to be pushy. My question is, well, what do they understand about the performance environment? How can I work with them to support a performance environment rather than seeing them as something, as a challenge? They're probably more important than I am. In fact, they are more important than I am. So how can we equip parents to do a really good job? We know parents love their children, want the best for them, but do they know what the best is for them in terms of performance? Usually not. So as a coach, how do I work with parents to allow them to understand how they can help the process, how they can support the process without compromising it for their children and for other children on the program?
Yeah, I think that's massive, because I mean, one of the things I try to hammer home to my athletes is, you know, it sounds a bit extreme, but the idea of being a 24-hour athlete, like if I've got you for 1 hour today, you've got 23 hours to go and completely undermine everything we just did with how you sleep, how you eat, how you recover, you know, all those things. And I think often there's a bias towards the importance of getting training done, getting, you know, the sets and reps done. And then, you know, that's the peak of the pyramid. Everything else will just happen. But actually, as we know, it's so reliant on everything else that happens when we don't see them. Like, what, you know, the lunch they're having at school, or how long they spend on their iPhone before they go to bed, and all those kind of things that parents do see and do have a better understanding of.
Mm-hmm. And use cycling as a good example as well. So riders that may not get onto a pathway program or whatever may go over to Belgium, for example, to ride for teams over there, or over to France. And then they find themselves in a shitty flat in a country where not everyone is willing to speak English, where they're racing against Eastern Europeans who have got no money and need to win to eat. I've come across so many riders that have lasted a fortnight out in these environments. So the bigger question is, how do we equip athletes to deal with those challenges? And the challenge isn't necessarily getting the training done if the fire's in the tummy. The challenge is maintaining friendships, maintaining a relatively balanced life, maybe maintaining some sort of study as well, and having some sort of academic focus or career focus, because that transition, whether it's from being an academy player up to pro level, whether it's getting injured and having to do a proper job, these transitions are absolutely fundamental to what I do as a coach. What happens if it all ends tomorrow? And it does for the majority of people. It does end, and when there's nothing to fill that gap, nothing to move on to, then it typically becomes a real problem. So, as a coach, it's about having that a holistic outlook of life. I'm a bothered if an athlete has a few glasses of wine or goes out with their mates or is a bit tired one day and doesn't fancy training. Absolutely not. If I get a call saying I don't want to train today, I'm all right, that's fine. I don't need to have a reason. That's because it's not about me, it's about others achieving their dreams. So whatever their motivation is for not doing something, that's important to them. And if they've consistently not got the motivation to do what they're doing, then they're not going to transition up to the next level. It's as simple as that. They won't have the fire in their tummy to enable them to do that. So that motivation has got to be internal and intrinsic. And I certainly, as a coach, don't feel the need to control the behavior of anyone. I want to influence it in a positive way. And sometimes we see through institutionalized programs the need to control performance and the need to control the behaviors of others, when fundamentally it comes down to that intrinsic motivation of the athlete and being able to cope with the challenges that they face within the environment they've got. And we sometimes lose sight of that. And club level, program level, sometimes the challenges that are presented to athletes are very unhelpful towards performance. So we need to learn or help them equip athletes to deal with these challenges. We spoke a little bit about rugby players before having conflicting agendas between, say, school rugby and academy rugby and maybe international rugby and regional rugby. How do we equip parents and athletes to deal with those challenges? We've got multiple stakeholders with different agendas. You know, your job is about managing these conflicting agendas. How do we empower athletes to take control of that and say to their PE teacher, no, I'm working with Scotland this week, or this is my goal. How do we equip parents to be able to present those messages in a way that's not seen as overly challenging too? So this, my favorite phrase is, don't be a dick. It's as simple as that. How not to be a dick but still do the right thing. And it's really challenging to find that happy medium, but you need the skills to be able to do it.
Definitely. I mean, what you've spoken to there about transitions and the importance of being able to manage those is so true. I mean, you know, even the person that has that glittering successful career, the Chris Hoy, at some point in time, there's not going to be an Olympian anymore. They're not going to be in the Olympic Games again. And, you know, there's a transition. Equally, that 16-year-old kid who drops out. So there's three rules that you really pulled out that I thought were great, which you said were fundamental to dealing with the world of high-performance sports. So can you delve into those for us a little bit?
Oh, I've got to remember them now. So number one is shit happens. Two, life is not fair. And three is the goalposts change. Now, life and sport is complex, ever-evolving, changing all these things. And my experience in life as well is shit does happen. It regularly happens. We've got COVID going on right now. That's probably the biggest shit we've had happening since World War II for most people. These sorts of things do happen, and there are sorts of things we need to face in life. And what's really important is how we deal to cope, or how we learn to cope with such challenges. Is it the end of the world? Well, if you recognize that shit does happen, it's almost easier to deal with. It's quite similar to Buddhist practice in considering that until you become a Buddha, then suffering is inevitable. That's a precept of life. Suffering is inevitable. So I'm bringing a phrase like shit happens to Buddhist practice, but it relates. life is not fair. When we think about, well, everyone's got different ways of seeing the world. I've just met you. I don't know how you think. I don't necessarily understand how other people think and see the world either, and they may see it a different way. So right now, probably as we speak, my partner, she works in a major financial institution, and they're having cuts right now, rationalizing. So they're making decisions on who's made redundant or not, going through relatively trying to make subjective processes objective to decide who loses their job or not. Those who may be a mark or two on what the wrong side of the boundary are going to lose their jobs. Simple. Carnage will ensue. Some of them will have young families. They may well think life is not fair. That's probably, they're going through emotional turmoil right now, thinking I might lose my job. And when they do, they think that's not fair. I'm better than such and such. That's the reality of high performance sport. If you're on that boundary, if you're just on that boundary between maybe making it and maybe not, there's those that are clearly not good enough and those that are clearly are that sit above or below. But when you're in that middle ground that selectors have a long chat about, saying, do we keep this person on or do we not? It's quite a subjective process based on people's opinions. So when you're in that area, it's important to recognize that life's not fair. Most people are trying to do their best, trying to be as objective as possible, but it might be that you are that person that is treated in such a way that you believe it isn't fair. If you accept that that's the case, it makes life easier. Then it allows you to ask the question, well, what do I need to do differently to help others make a different decision next time? What do I need to do to be better, rather than saying, or just saying, yeah, life's not fair, let's move on. What can I do about it to be selected, or what can I do about it to be the best performer I can? And also in sport, you may have clear process goals, need to know where you need to get to. Do everything that's ever been expected of you. But right now we see across multiple sports programs that their funding's being cut. Programs are getting cut. Coaches are losing their jobs. So that some athletes who have had clear expectations that they're going to be on a program, that program might not be there anymore with COVID. The goalposts have changed, and that's inevitable in life. So these are key psychological tools. I took some of them from the work of Steve Peters, the psychiatrist that worked from British Cycling, and that's kind of where the rules come from. Is working with athletes and helping them recognize that these are almost the precepts of sport, that shit happens, life's not fair, and the goalposts change. Deal with it. And then the next question as a clinician or a coach is, how do I help you cope? How do I help you cope with these circumstances? How can I help you be better? Not getting overly frustrated and crying over spilt milk. A proper job where you've got an arse of a boss or colleagues that are annoying. That's not fair. That's not nice. But we've got to cope with it. It's the nature of reality. It's the nature of life. It just happens to be that it's far more ruthless in sport. And what we tend to find as well is that there's probably more people with darker behaviors in sport too. And what I mean by that is narcissistic, slightly psychopathic behaviors, and that these real drives, not necessarily with the expertise to do a great job either in some instances. So that makes it even more difficult. It's ruthless, and it's got ruthless people in the environment ready to trip you up. So understanding these rules and being able to cope with them is absolutely fundamental to high performance sport.
That leads really nicely when you talk about, you know, dealing with difficult individuals, etc. One of the points you raised in that guide was around the training and competition environment and how athletes and parents should kind of be considering, you know, certain factors when weighing up whether a training environment is a positive one or not. So what were some of those things that you think are important that parents are maybe observing and considering, as, you know, is this ideal or is this desirable in a training environment?
Well, there's simple ways to treat human beings. It comes down to humility for me. Are people being treated with respect? Would you expect to send a child to school and have the teacher say, "You look fat"? Would you send a child to school and expect the teacher to shout at them? Would you expect the teacher not to speak to you if you had failed your exam? No. So why should it be any different in sport? Getting the best out of people means treating them with respect, helping them develop the skills to cope with real challenges, but ultimately it comes down to treating them with respect. So asking a simple question are, how did you enjoy training today? Now, it's maybe not a simple question with a teenager, for example, saying, tell me about this. But these questions are absolutely fundamental. Does a kid want to go to training? Have they got rigor prior to going to training? Are they excited about seeing their mates? Or is there a tension in them? Are they worried about something? It's real simple things. Now, the challenge with teenagers, for example, is they're not the best at showing their emotions to adults. So sometimes that's difficult to make sense of. But for parents, showing you love your children, not put too many demands on them in terms of that performance, but have an open dialogue and try to get them to be open as well. It is really important. I think what we must recognize as well, and this comes from psychology and brain development and whatever as well, is that, and some people never actually develop it, but the prefrontal cortex, for example, in teenagers isn't designed to think about long-term thinking and goals. It's designed to think about staying close to your mates and gaining your independence. It's not about what's happening in your career in 20 years' time. Simply not designed to work in that way. So expecting children to have long-term goals is unrealistic. You want them to have a nice time with their friends. You want them to enjoy their sport, and beyond that, we can't predict. So it's the question, are you having a good time? Do you want to go to training? Do you want the day off? What worries me in some sports, for example, swimming. Some clubs insist that swimmers must go to a set number of training sessions every week, probably 12, 13 hours for someone that's dealing with big hormonal changes, peak height velocity changes, all these types of things, as well as beginning to develop as a person as well. And then saying, oh, but you must train 15 hours a week. No. As a parent, I'm not a parent, but I would be saying, why are these processes in place that are insisting that my children must go there? What do they know that I don't? And that's right on the border of abusive behavior to me. It shouldn't compel anyone to be doing sport, regardless. Do they want to go? Do they want to go under their own steam? If they don't, that's fine.
So just coming towards our last couple of questions, because we're conscious of time, you've obviously created a fantastic resource that I'll link to in the show notes for people who haven't come across the Warts and All guide yet. But are there any other resources that you would recommend to listeners if they're interested in some of these areas we've mentioned?
I'm going to say no. And the simple reason I'm saying no is that through telling people stuff, behavior doesn't typically change. I would say the key is to have an open mind, to always ask the question why, and listen for responses. If you're a parent listening, it's why is my child being asked to do this? Can that be articulated to me? And it's kind of the way I think about it, having that open mind. I've been fortunate enough to work across probably over 10 sports, seen many different cultures and different sports, and the way problems are solved in rugby, for example, are very different to how they're solved in cycling. But there's things we can learn from each other. It's having that inquisitive, open mind and not being afraid to challenge, to push hard if you need to, but try not to be too much of a dick whilst doing it. Because we see from the stories of gymnastics, for example, something I've written on as well, the questions are, why is my child being asked to do this? Why are they comfortable with their diet? What's really in their best interest? And having that inquisitiveness and asking the right questions, being able to ask the right questions and informing yourself, learning the basics, engaging with coaches. And if coaches aren't open, if they can't answer questions and you sense that your children aren't happy, then it's really easy. You pull the plug. I've got an example of someone that I used to work with who's an expert in their sport, who's got a very talented kid who refused to let them go on to a performance pathway because their knowledge was such that they thought, well, assessing 13-year-olds on A, B, and C isn't right, and the other parents there aren't really helping that environment. It's not an environment I think is right for my child right now. And it is these sorts of tensions that you sense, that you see how people interact with each other, expectations. The real question is, why is it like that? Is it salutary to the well-being of our children? And if not, simple, pull the plug and let them do something else.
That's brilliant. I mean, it's been a fantastic conversation today. And I really, it's one of those things where you could go on for another hour or two, because I'm sure we could get further and further into more and more things. But I mean, it's been a great, I guess, overview of the guide that you've written. And I would really recommend that listeners go and read that if they haven't, and I'll make sure to signpost people to. But otherwise, where can people find out more about you and about your work in terms of website, social media, et cetera?
Right. So I'm on Twitter. It's AndyKirkland71. So Twitter is the best way to find me. I do have my own webpage, but I don't keep it up to date too much now because I'm busy doing other things. And a simple Google. So I've written quite a lot of stuff for Training Peaks. So it's an online coaching platform in endurance sport. Much of what I write there relates to coaching practice and even behavioral change science and so on, you know, things about good coaching. So a lot of what I do goes on to Training Peaks because it gives me an international audience. So that's a really good place. And I have my landing page at the University of Stirling too. I'm always willing, within reason, to have conversations with people. So if there's parents thinking, I've got some challenges here. Recently, I worked with a parent who was having challenges with deciding what program to put their kid within, and had real challenges in understanding what was best. So I'm always open to speaking to people, and if others want to find me, it's pretty easy.
Brilliant. Well, thanks again so much for your time today. It's been great speaking to you, and really appreciate it.
Brilliant, Rob. Thanks very much. Cheers.